This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
Now for Gospel and Scripture with Brother Len on Golden Guide.
As the world looks upon me, as I struggle along, they say I have nothing, but they are so wrong. In my heart I'm rejoicing, how I wish they could see. Thank you, Lord, for your blessings on me.
From the people of God, welcome to this program, Golden Guide. The scripture says, there is a way which seem right unto a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death or destruction. From Proverbs chapter 14, verse 12. So therefore, we need the Golden Guide.
Hello and welcome to this series of lectures entitled, Come Search With Me. It really is an invitation to you to walk with me as we go through this journey of inquiry. I was born and brought up in India, a land of tremendous diversity in language, culture, food, dress. In fact, this dress that I am wearing is from the northern parts of India. There's another part that is really diverse in that country, and it is the question of religious beliefs. Hinduism is its dominant religion, and India has the largest population of Hindus in the world. India also has the second largest Muslim population in the world. In fact, we have more Muslims in India than we have in the whole Arabian Peninsula put together. Buddhism was born and cradled and nurtured in the eastern parts of India. Tradition tells us that Christianity came to India in its very first generation. Saint Thomas came there, and even today there are monuments to his name. Sikhism, Jainism, with the milieu of agnostics and atheists, that is the crucible in which I grew. Naturally, I had a whole lot of questions, and some of those questions bothered me, vexed me a great deal. So I went on a journey of inquiry, a journey that went on and on for more than 20 years. I asked people and then read up. After I finished the 20 years of search, I tried to spend the next 5 years in organizing the material into a stepwise reasoning that I would find acceptable and actually satisfying to me. And this is what gave rise to my seminar called Come Search With Me. So I would like now to invite you to come with me on this journey. We'll go through it briefly, but I hope we can learn something out of this presentation. The question is big. And when we address such a big question, it is usually wise to lay a foundation first. Here's a statement, and it's a purpose statement. This seminar has been deliberately designed to encourage critical thinking in regards to a common topic that appears to elude universal agreement at present. The question is about God, and there are many facets to this question. One of them is the following. There is a great, what I call a great divide. One side says God, in quotes, the side of the atheists, who say that God is non-existent and fictitious. The other side, B, believer, says that God is relevant and factual. How shall we address such a big question with our small minds? Will we be competent to do it? Well, listen to the statement by Henry G. Statements from authorities in a field should be as subject to scrutiny as those emanating from the most humble sources, even a beginning student. So that includes you and me. Here's another statement by Judge Graham. Science is not an inscrutable priesthood. Any person of reasonable intelligence should, with some diligence, be able to understand and critically evaluate a scientific theory. In other words, we should not be intimidated and overwhelmed by a string of PhDs behind a person's name. Whatever is said, however the theory is expressed, we can try to bring it down to our level and scrutinize it, evaluate it, examine it. So that's what we are going to do with this big question of, is there a God in existence or is there not a God in existence? It is a very peculiar debate. It is not A versus B. It is rather A versus non-A. And here's what I mean. One side says, for example, there is an apple on this table and it's in the next room. The other side says, there is no apple, there is no table, there is not even the next room in existence. You can see immediately that they are far apart in their claims. In other words, if you are on one side, you are not in the other. If you are on this side, you are not on the other side. Mutually exclusive. Not only that, but if you are on one side, then the concepts of that one side hold you completely in its grasp. It envelops you completely. Similarly, if you're on the other side, the concepts here completely envelops you. So in other words, not only are they separate and distinct, they are all encompassing. And if that's the case, then there is actually no middle ground. But people say there is. They call it agnosticism. But agnosticism is only a confession of inability to choose. I don't know. That's what they say. Agnostic. A is without gnosis, knowledge, without sufficient information to make a reasonable decision. But it is not a real option. Why do I say so? Let me give you an example. If I put my hand behind my back and ask you whether there is an apple or an orange in my hand, if you say, I don't know, does that I don't know create a third fruit called I don't know? It does not. Saying I don't know is only a confession. The only two options are theism and atheism, and they cannot be more widely separated. They are so distinct and far apart. Agnosticism, therefore, is impractical. Why would I say that? Because, here's an example. These two jurisdictions are widely separate. Let's look at two countries, for example. The United States, where I now live, and India, where I was born. In the United States, we drive on the right side of the road, whereas in India, we drive on the left side of the road. Suppose we come to a position in which we are at the wheel, but we don't know. We don't know in which country we are. Does that I don't know allow you to make a third country in which you drive on the median? Of course not. You still have only two countries. And that's why I said agnosticism is quite impractical. Why? Because at any given point, an agnostic makes decisions as if theism is relevant, God exists, or as if atheism is relevant, God is non-existent. Agnosticism is not a real option. But here's a statement by Kurt Gödel that throws a spanner in the whole works. He enunciated in The Last Generation a theorem known as the incompleteness theorem. He mathematically proved that a firm theory, that means a claim that this is the established truth, is valid only if all the pertinent data is at hand and is taken into consideration. But really, who can claim to have all the data relating to our question? Nobody. So everyone, by mathematical certainty, is an agnostic, and only an agnostic. Whoa. So what shall we do? Is everybody is an agnostic, and at the same time, agnostic is not a practical solution. Well, I've thought it through, and here's what I'd like to say. Agnosticism, while it is the only correct and honest claim, it is also totally impractical and phantom-like in its position. So what about the believer and the unbeliever? Here it is. A theist or a believer is an agnostic who has chosen to believe in the existence of God, whereas an atheist is an agnostic who has chosen to believe that God is non-existent. What is common is that both are agnostics and both depend solidly on belief. But there's a difference, because the basis of that belief are widely different. And what are those bases? The theist's base is a confession that their belief they derive from a declaration in a book, for example, the Quran or the Rig Veda or the Torah. The atheist's base is a bold claim. They say their belief is based on scientific reasoning and logic. Now, at this point, if there is only a confession and a bold claim, then really the bold claim is impressive. I would agree and acknowledge to that. But confession or bold claim, both are beliefs. So with that word, let's push back or pull back a little bit. You know, when this topic comes up, everyone gets tight. We get tense. We want to win the argument. We don't like the other side to win. But let's pull back just a little bit about this question of personal beliefs. We, you and I, can choose what we want to believe as the truth of the matter, whether there is good evidence, no evidence, and even evidence to the contrary. Why? Because belief is a choice. Nobody can make you believe. They might be able to make you say something about your belief, but they can never make you believe. Belief is only your own property, personal and private. It has your name stamped on it. Nobody can believe for you, and you can't believe for somebody else. It is your own, and you can make a choice. Once you believe, or say that you believe, then you can state your belief, you can keep silent. You can also state what is not your belief. So what am I saying? I'm saying, friends, you and I are free. We are free to make our choices of belief. Nobody can force us. No matter what I put on the screen, it cannot force any of you to believe, because belief is your private property. Only you can take what I say and put on the screen, if you so choose, and put it in that place which is called the cubbyhole of your belief, and mull around and examine it, and if you choose, you add it onto your belief. So here's what we can draw back on. Nobody can make you believe. It's your own personal choice. But a personal choice does not make it true or false. In other words, beliefs do not create truth. So here I am with my personal belief, but may or may not be true. What shall I do? Well, we could have a way in which we can better this situation, and that is to put two heads together. Two are better than one. So let's make a community goal to look for which is a more credible claim. Theism or atheism? But if you and I are going to do it together, then we will have to make certain ground rules. And here's the ground rule I'd like for you to come along with me. We will depend and employ only evidence, not mere opinion. Only logic, not illogic. Only reason, not absurdity. So with these three, let's try to see how we can make a choice. Why is this debate inconclusive? It's been going on for decades and generations and even centuries. When I looked at it, here are some reasons why we might come to understand why it is inconclusive. Terms are not defined, the evidence is not defined, and there's lack of neutrality and something known as confirmation bias. Let's look at them. Do you know that atheists and theists disagree on the most basic term, God? How can you have a discussion if you disagree on the most basic term? Have you heard people say, who made God? If you say God made us, then who made God? The very question shows that the meaning of the word God is not agreed to by both sides. Because God, by definition, in some people's mind, is an uncreated being, unmade. So how can you ask that question? So right there, we are on two different wavelengths. And it cannot be a good, reasonable discussion. Evidence. Theists, believers in God, claim that they can describe evidence for the existence of God. Atheists are silent. They have never described the nature of the evidence that they say is missing. And believe me, I've gone all over the world. For 10 years I've asked, what is it that is missing, which if it was there, would show everyone that there is a God in existence? Some have tried to answer that, but the moment we get into a discussion, they fall back and are silent. So if we have not come to an agreement on even the question of evidence, how can we have a reasonable discussion? Neutrality. Each side approaches the question from its own angle and never from the center. You can go anywhere. And a person may be undecided, but never takes a central, neutral position. They appear incapable of starting out neutral. And why is that? It's because of confirmation bias, which is the tendency to recall, select, or interpret evidence in a way that supports one's pre-existing beliefs. And how many people have confirmation bias? Everyone. Everyone has confirmation bias. 100% of the inhabitants on planet Earth. So, don't call anyone biased. Not because they're not biased, but because everyone is biased. Look, if everyone is only short-statured, what is the point in saying, get the short guy, I want to talk to him? No, it won't make any sense. So don't call anyone biased, and don't be called biased by anyone, not because we are not biased, but because everyone is biased. Why are we struggling with bias? You know, when I looked into it, I found something very interesting. Everyone, you and me, have in our minds three distinct attitudes. The attitude of a skeptic, the attitude of a believer, and the attitude of an inquirer. What do I mean by these? For example, the skeptical attitude, as soon as it hears a report, will dismiss it without even going into an inquiry. Whereas a believing attitude will simply swallow because they like it. An inquiring attitude will hold verdict until the investigation is done. Here's another set. A skeptic focuses on the question to the exclusion of the evidence because he doesn't like it. So dump as many questions there to destroy the report. Whereas the believer will look for the evidence. He doesn't want to look at any questions that are there. He dismisses the questions. Whereas an inquirer focuses on the weight of evidence. Now, what should you and me be if we want to make a fair inquiry? We should become inquirers, right? Not stay skeptical, not stay believing, but put them away and become inquirers. The difficulty is really this, that the skeptic also can inquire, the believer also can inquire. We may inquire as a believer or a skeptic and think we are fair, but that is not true inquiry because we are not looking to know the truth, but to find evidence to support our own stand. The challenge is to become inquiring inquirers, not skeptical inquirers, not believing inquirers. Suppose we've stated that, and we want to become inquiring inquirers. It's only fair that we paint a picture of what an inquiring inquirer looks like. So here are 3 points. An inquirer in a controversial debate will never look at only one side. He always makes a counter proposal so that there are two proposals. Do you know why? Let me quiz you. It's a trick question. When is a good decision a bad decision? And when is a bad decision a good decision? Wheels turning? Okay, let me tell you. A good decision might turn out to be bad if the alternatives were better and best and all you chose was the good. On the other hand, a bad decision might be a good decision if the alternatives were worse and worst. So when you made a bad decision, you avoided the worst and the worst, and therefore that bad decision is a good decision. What am I saying? If there are two sides, don't look at only one, because you might come to the conclusion this is good and you'll choose it without looking at the other side, whereas if you had looked at the other side, that was better and maybe the best, but you only chose the good. On the other hand, you could look at one side and say, boy, that is bad. I am not going to go that way. But you didn't look on the other side because that would have been worse and worst. So your bad decision might be actually a good decision. So two options are always made. The second point, once you make the two options, you hold those as equal. I still remember presenting this at one of the meetings, and one of them came up to me and said, boy, you offend me. I felt offended when you said there are two equal options. I said, well, if you're an inquiring inquirer, you have to consider them equal. So we have two. You stand in the middle and consider them equal. And what do we mean by saying equal? We mean this. Either option, and we say it honestly from deep within, either option will be acceptable as long as it is based on what we had agreed earlier, evidence, logic, reason. Are you thinking? Let me ask you, those of you who believe that there's a God in existence, if today I show you some reasonable evidence on the screen that actually the weight of evidence points to there being no God in existence, then will you be willing tomorrow to become an atheist? How about you, the others? If you believe that there is no God in existence, and today I show you some reasonable evidence that there is, after all, the supernatural, and there is a God in existence, then would you be willing to become a believer, a theist by tomorrow morning? Wow. Now, it's a different ball game, right? What am I saying? It takes raw guts to become an inquirer. It takes unfailing courage to remain one. So, we want to become inquiring inquirers. So let's make a decision, you and me, so that we are on the same journey together. How long do you think you will stay and remain an inquirer after making a decided position that you will be an inquirer? Do you know how long? I don't know for sure, but I'd guess that you'd remain an inquirer for all of 2 minutes plus or minus a few seconds. Poke the bubble, burst it. The fact is, we go zooming down to our side because we have confirmation bias. We are unable to do anything about this. And that's why, if you really want to become an inquirer, an inquiring inquirer, then we need help. Agreed? Yes, we need help. We need to create an atmosphere in which we remain inquirers, at least get the best chance to become, remain an inquirer. So here's what I would propose, that we need four things, four factors to form that atmosphere. Number one, humility. Number two, honesty. Number three, calmness. And number four, respect. Let's go through each of them briefly. Humility. It is a learning attitude, a teachable spirit. We don't stand there with our chest puffed up saying, I know it all. In other words, it is standing small in the face of the vastness and grandeur of the information in our universe. Once you look at that, you become small in your own eyes, and that is humility. You begin to say, what do you have to say? I'm willing to listen. I'm willing to be taught. Honesty. This is really in short supply. I've talked to all kinds of people, not just the ones who are ordinary like you and me, but those who are at the top, the pastors, the bishops, the priests, the monks, the mullahs, and oh my, the amount of white lies and sometimes blatant falsehood that comes out. You know, I'll confess that sometimes I felt quite disgusted until I turned that question to myself and I asked, how honest are you? And oh, the revelation. I was just as dishonest as any of them out there. So in my evaluation of my honesty, if I was supposed to be honest, then I was honestly pretty dishonest. What do I do? Here I'm looking for something that I feel I should get at, but what if I'm dishonest? I realized I had to do something about it. So here's what I did. I made a definition of honesty, and I said, that is what will drive me during the whole search. And here's my definition. The willingness to give credit to a point or argument, no matter who brings it to the table, and even if that credit has the possibility of destroying my own previous stand, and I've signed it electronically with my name, that is what would drive me. Boy, it has teeth in it. You're not going to just stand on one side and let all the ideas just pile up on your side. No, you're going to be open. You know what I called it? I called it the wow factor. Say wow when anything is impressive. Don't start scratching your head and saying, wait a minute. If I say wow, then who will get the point and the credit? Maybe he or she, not me, so I'm going to withhold. Nope, that won't be honesty. If it is impressive, just go ahead and say wow. You ready? Maybe we should be ready to say wow. Let's try it. 22 over 7 is pi. Actually, it's not 22 over 7. If you really do the math, it is 3.142, and it goes on and on in a very random fashion. So people have made that into a memory test. How many digits can you memorize? Do you know what the world record is? Take a guess. What do you think would be the maximum that a person might possibly remember? How many digits? A few years ago, this was the world record. It was held by Hideaki Tomoyori, a Japanese, who stood before hundreds of people, and over 17 hours and more, he recited pi to the 40,000th digit before making the first mistake. You got to say wow to that. I said wow. So that's what I mean. If something is impressive, you got to say wow. Calmness. Very important. Because anger really is against clear thinking, and hostility fights good judgment. In other words, if you let your emotions come up, which is very common in this topic, then out go judgment and reasoning out the window. You can't have both. So we've got to hold our emotions down. You know, when I speak like this, and when I present these seminars, there will be statements and ideas that I present that will really jar you. Can't help it. We are doing an honest search. But don't get angry. Don't get upset when I make some statement that really hits against you. Here's the challenge. When you hear something you completely disagree, then say to yourself, I disagree with this man. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to make a good argument, so good and strong that it will destroy his argument. If you want to really do that, you have to keep calm and collected, not upset and angry. Only then can you make a good argument to knock off mine. If you get upset and angry, we're not going to have a discussion, we'll have a fight, and that's not what we want. Calmness is holding your emotions in check. It is a natural outcome of possessing humility and honesty. Respect. Respect is not agreement. In fact, actually, it shines out best when there is disagreement. It is not admiration either, although we use these terms synonymous. What is it? It is the right we give others to make their own choices and beliefs, even if those beliefs come out to be diametrically opposite ours. We give them the right. So also, we expect them to give us the right to do that. And so we are mutually respectful. We never look down our noses. We never treat them condescendingly, with pity, as if they know less than we. No, we respect them. We hold them equal to ourselves, and we say you have equal right to do whatever search you want and come to whatever conclusion you want to. So these four: humility, honesty, calmness, respect. They are a foursome that will probably create the best chance we have. It's not only in this debate, my friends. If you use these four in any situation in life, wherever there's a controversial topic, I think that no matter how bitter the fight, if you use these four, you will get into the argument, you will get into the discussion, and even if you disagree to your heart's content, you can come back to be friends at the end of the discussion. You will not fight. Use these four. They really will take you the distance. If you start from one end or one side, the tendency is to have two columns of argument. Mine, yours. So what I will do is pile up all the evidences on my side and look at all the deficiencies you have and point out those deficiencies. If there are holes, shoot. and knock you down. So two columns. But remember, we didn't start from the side. We do not want to do that. We have to start from the middle. And if that's the case, then I developed this idea called the PAN process. The PAN process does not have just two columns of argument, yours and mine. It has four columns. We look at both the options and we fight for both. Then we turn around and we fight against both. So we have four columns of arguments. Against and for A, and for and against B. That is the PAN process. What's the meaning of PAN? One meaning is that it goes across. A few years ago, we had the Pan American Airlines. It went across America. In other words, the process must take you across. Don't sit in one corner. Across. Go across. Pan also means to sift. Way back in the 1800s, the gold rush in California, the people came there to pan for gold. What's the meaning of panning? They had to sift. Shift out the mundane and ordinary from the valuable. That's the other name or the meaning of PAN. The third meaning, it just happens to be the first three letters of my family name, Pandit. So the PAN process is what we're going to do. It has four columns of arguments. Are you ready to get on to do the PAN process as an inquirer, as an inquiring inquirer? Let's go. Four columns of argument. Column one, arguments for atheism, the claim that God is non-existent. How many arguments? None. Wow, that is surprising. You know, you would never have come to that if you had not done the PAN process. Because the PAN process makes you come to be disciplined and discuss only one column at a time. And in this column, there are no arguments for atheism. Why? Because the statement of atheism is a negative statement. There is no God in existence. God is non-existent. And a negative statement is valid only when every possibility has been exhausted. Example? If I say there's nobody in this room by the name of Mr. Brown, how many names should I know before I make that statement boldly and correctly and confidently? I should know every name. Here's another example. If there are 10,000 lakes in the United States, and I sit up here very confidently and say, there is no lake by the name Char-Gog-Agog Man-Chow-Gagog Chow-Banagan-Gamaug, how many lakes should I know and be familiar with? I should know all 10,000 lakes and their names. Only then can I say there is no lake by the name Char-Gog-Agog Man-Chow-Gagog Chow-Banagan-Gamaug. Incidentally, this name is the name of a real lake in Upper Massachusetts in the United States. It's in the Native American language, and translated it says, I fish on my side of the lake and you fish on your side of the lake and nobody fishes in between. But the point really is, if I should say that there is no lake by that name, I should know all 10,000 lakes. Let's apply this. If there is a God in existence, if, then he should be somewhere. In other words, the location is important. So let me ask, how many of you are conversant and familiar with every nook and corner of your town? No, he may be in somebody's closet, right? How about the world? No. Anyone been to the moon? Do you know that the moon has the light side and the dark side? And the dark side is always dark because that's how it is configured in the planetary system. It always faces the sun with one side. What if he set up his office on the dark side of the moon? Hey, it'll be hard to find that out. Have you been to the sun? 93 million miles away. Anywhere close by there? No. The sun is a star in our Milky Way galaxy. How many stars do you think there are in our Milky Way galaxy? guesstimated by the astronomers. You know, there are 200 billion stars. Been to anywhere there? Mm-mm. How many galaxies are there that the astronomers tell us? You know, they look at one part of the sky, count the number of galaxies, and then they extrapolate that into the rest of the sky. They say there are over 200 billion with a B, 200 billion galaxies. In other words, if you look away from the Milky Way out into space, most of what you will see are galaxies, not stars. How many of them have you gone to? None. Look, even if you had checked out 99% of the known universe, you would still have 2 billion galaxies to go before you make that statement that I've checked it out everywhere and he simply is not anywhere. Furthermore, if there is a God, and if he made you and me and the world, then if I can walk and run, we should deduce that he also can walk and run, or move. So if I go to the kitchen looking for him, he could have gone to the living room. If I go to Canada, he could have gone to India. Got it? In other words, for us, any one of us, to say that there is no God in existence, we should know every nook and cranny of the entire known universe at the same time. Boy, that's a tall order. What does it mean? It really means some words we use as the attributes of God. Omniscient, you know every corner, nook and corner. And omnipresent, you have access to every place. You know everything at the same time. Those are the attributes of God. So, here's the conclusion we have to come to. If we have to honestly and reasonably say that there is no God, then we should have the attributes of God. Or become a God yourself. But then if you become a God yourself, you can't say there is no God. So in this column, no arguments. How many marks would you give this column out of 100? Has to be 0. Let's go to the next column. Column number 2, and in this column we talk about arguments against theism, the claim that there is a God in existence. We'll look at 4 of them. They say, can you have evidence? And what they mean by evidence is empirical evidence. What's empirical evidence? It is evidence that's direct. Seeing, hearing, touching. I agree. There's no empirical evidence, but there are many other things that we accept without empirical evidence. How many of you really have empirical evidence that water is H2O? 2 of hydrogen and 1 of oxygen. Have you ever checked it out whether that is really it? No, we deduced that. So there's no empirical evidence, but we all take it to be the truth of the matter. So, we don't have to have empirical evidence to make a good decision. How about lack of design? Yes. There are many places on earth where everything is at random. No design. No pattern. At the same time, my friends, there are places that have pattern and design. So really, when you look at the fact that there is no pattern, it has to be balanced with the other fact that there is a pattern. So it is not a solid argument. Not yet. How about number 3, which is a big one? If you say that there is a loving, almighty God, then how can you explain this evil, pain, and suffering that we all have every day in this world? What's the explanation? And since we don't have an explanation that is satisfying to us, and the contradiction is too big, we say God is non-existent. That is the argument that is made. But let's look carefully at that argument. And like I said, critically think Here's a few ways of looking at it. Who is asking the question that there is a discrepancy? Everyone. The theist as well as the atheist. So if both of them have this as a burning, disturbing question, then the presence of pain and suffering cannot be the ultimate decider, because even with the pain and suffering, there are people who say, you can put it aside, because they do believe in God. In other words, in the face of pain and suffering, they still can accept the existence of God. In other words, then the pain and suffering cannot be the final decider. Point number two. Why do they say that it's a pointer to atheism? Because there's a contradiction. But a contradiction in features is not proof of non-existence. So this person is nice in the morning and nasty in the evening. Is he non-existent? No. The challenge when you see a contradiction is to get at the solution. It gives no license to dissolve the whole entity just because there's a contradiction. Third, why is it such a hard thing? Because it goes against the grain. Almighty loving God, pain and suffering. Clash. There's a clash of ideas. And therefore, we throw it out. But what if we find something that is in line with an almighty loving God? Shouldn't that also have its own weight? What am I saying? What am I pointing to? The fact that we don't have only pain and suffering in our lives. We also have joys and pleasures and delights. So if a contradiction points to atheism, then that which is not a contradiction should point to his existence. To be fair, if evil and suffering denote the absence of God, then joys and pleasures should denote the presence of God. Just to be fair, and we said we were fair, standing right in the middle, taking no sides. But the clincher to this is the next point. If there exists evidence for the absence of an entity, as well as evidence for the presence of that entity, then that entity is present. Oh wow, that's a long sentence. How do we know it's true? A simple example would clarify what I'm saying. Let us say the jurisdiction or the area we're looking at is this hall. And we want to know whether there's a mouse in this hall. The evidence for the absence of a mouse is a white spot. And the evidence for the presence of a mouse is a red spot. And mice sit under the chairs. So that is our theory. Mice sit under the chairs. A white spot is evidence for the absence of a mouse. A red spot is evidence for the presence of a mouse. Now let's look at this room. We go from this chair, white spot, white spot, white spot, white spot, everywhere white spot except that last bed, chair there. Under that one chair, there is one red spot. Is there a mouse in this hall? Of course there is. What's the dictum? One piece of evidence for the presence will negate all the evidence for the absence of that entity. Let's apply it. If both evil and suffering, absence of God, as well as joys and pleasures, presence of God, are present in our lives, in our world, in our existence, then God exists. It's simple and it's pretty straightforward. You don't have to really have a convoluted sense of ideas to come to this. In other words, in column number two, which are pointers against theism, we come to a very startling conclusion. that their most powerful point is actually on the other side. Let's go on to the fourth one, creation. The problem with creation that any rational thinker has is that there's no observational data. In other words, nobody has seen creation taking place. And secondly, nobody can point to any scientific law or rule which tells us how creation could have possibly taken place. So, nobody saw it, no natural explanation. So it's difficult to believe. Granted, it really is difficult. But if we do not want creation, then what's the alternative? There are many, but let me point to one of them. It's called the standard model, in which the beginning point is not God, keep him out, that's theism. Here it is called singularity, a point at which the entire universe was once upon a time in the form of pure energy. No mass, just energy. Energy does not occupy space, so it was one point. That point expanded into the universe. But singularity, when you look at it, has great deficiencies in trying to explain how we could have singularity. There are many questions, big questions, that arise. So how do the physicists go past those questions? Here's how they do it. They say that the laws of physics do not exist in a singularity. How about Stephen Hawking, who said in real time the universe has a beginning at singularity, at which the laws of science break down? Huh, did you get the point? The singularity has no natural laws explaining it. So, nobody has seen singularity, so there's lack of observational information regarding singularity. There's lack of any scientific explanation regarding singularity. How different is that from creation? Can you see that all the points that are raised against theism, against the idea that God is in existence, is always balanced out by some other factor? And in fact, the big one, pain and suffering, really shifts you to the opposite side. How many marks do you think you would give this column? The first column was zero. This one does not have huge marks, my friend. In fact, I would be tempted to put minus because the big point went to the other side. I'd say 20 points. Let's go to the third one. The third column, arguments for theism, for the claim that there is a God in existence. Let's go through four of them. Number one, circumstantial. What's the meaning of circumstantial? Just a pointer. Not a proof, just a pointer. The numbers, billions believe. If just one person told me that they saw a white crow, I'd say, hey, wait a minute. But if 10 people said, well, we really saw one. It was a crow and it was white. I'd say, okay, I'll give it a chance. If 500 people said they saw that crow, then I would not throw the claim out. I would say, let's look for an explanation. Probably it was an albino. What I'm saying is that I wouldn't throw it out. It becomes circumstantial evidence. Number two, it's very deep in the human psyche. We have about 5,000 years of human history. Do you know that in not one single generation has the idea of God ever been wiped out? Not even a single one. It is very deep in the human psyche. So it does become a circumstantial evidence. And number three, the presence of design and purpose. People say that it's just apparent purpose. Wait a minute. What is the difference between apparent design and a real design? It couldn't be in the pattern because the pattern is there for both. You know, a few weeks ago, I was at the Napa Valley in Northern California. They have these vineyards. And if you go looking at a vineyard from a certain angle, it looks like all the plants are planted at random. And you can go from at this angle, this angle, this angle, this angle, random. But suddenly you come to one angle and you see every plant in straight, real straight, like an arrow rose. So is there a design or not? Just because the majority of angles showed non-design, it does not mean there is no design. One angle is enough to show that there is design. And if there is design, my friends, there is a designer. So these are circumstantial. How about the anthropic principle? What's the meaning of anthropos? It's human. And the meaning is that there are factors that contribute and stew and sustain human life on a planet like ours. And those are very finely tuned. That's the anthropic principle. They are very exact and precise. For example, the expansion rate. You know, the universe could have expanded at any rate. Say from 1 millimeter in a billion years to the speed of light. 186,000 miles per second. 300,000 kilometers per second. So the spectrum of the possibilities is huge. In fact, the statement says it is huge, the possibilities. A trillion, 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 trillion. A trillion of a trillion, of a trillion. In other words, there are that many possibilities, and out of those, only one's rate would have allowed us to live. If it was a little faster, a little slower, we could not have a universe that would be capable of supporting life. Similarly, with gravity, you know, the four basic fundamental forces in nature, the strong nuclear force, weak nuclear force, electromagnetism, and gravity. Which is the strongest? Strong nuclear force. Which is the weakest? Gravity. Do you know the spectrum? If you draw a line with millimeter marks on it, and swing that line across the globe and to the moon and to the sun and across the whole of our Milky Way galaxy, how many millimeter marks would you find on it? And what if you stretched that line to the next galaxy? Boy, we'd lost count completely of the millimeter marks. But those millimeter marks are the number of times that the strong nuclear force is bigger and greater than gravity. All right, impressed. Now, what would happen if we shifted gravity from the...
Friends, I invite you to listen to this program, Golden Guide, and the Power of Truth, here on Free FM 89.0, with me, Brother Lynn Fletcher, every Sunday at 6 until 7 o'clock in the evening. And thanks for your listening.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.